Streaming live around the world, this is Paper Cuts with Brad and Jay.
I'm the one you love. I'm Jay. Thanks so much for stopping by. Over there's Brad. It's his show.
It's his show. That's why I'm the host, and we just love Jay.
Now you know it's all natural. I mean, you know, nothing's rehearsed, right?
No, absolutely nothing is rehearsed on this show.
God, you just suck life out of me. It feels like
you've got a lot grayer since we started this.
I have. Tonight, oh, he's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
I'm just talking about Todd Kiesling.
We are live.
We are called Paper Cuts. Who came up? Remember that old
best intro ever.
Brad, do you remember the old ones? We're called Paper Cuts. Who came up with that name? The first one was the whole snapping thing you put together. What's up, everyone? Welcome to the show. That's Bradford over there. I'm Jay. We have this little show. It's the greatest show in the world of all shows, the history of all shows. It's the greatest. Think of the greatest show you ever watched, and then we're above that. Enough about us. This evening, we have someone who's no stranger to the show because he stalks us. Author of Devil's Creek, which everyone in the world has, correct?
Brad, if not, they should.
Hey, hold it up there for us, because I did not prepare for this. I could have grabbed it from the shelf, but I figured Brad would have it.
I didn't even prepare for this. So
it's all cool. Scan lines you may have, the final reconciliation you may have. I could go on and on, but you know, this is only a couple hours, and I have to go to work on Monday. He's back with a brand new collection, Cold Black and Infinite. Welcome to the show, everyone. Todd Kiesling. Hello, sir.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Todd. Guys. Hello, everybody watching. Thank you for tuning in.
See, there's people in the chat. You were afraid no one's going to show up for this.
It's a Friday night, you know, so I don't know.
It's, first of all, it's us.
I was saying it's us, so he's trepidatious and no one's going to show up.
Yeah, but since you're here, people are showing up, so.
They're here for Todd, not for us.
Hey, Kat. Nikki's here.
Nikki's here for Todd.
Speaking of Friday night, Todd, what are you normally doing besides talking to two bozos with microphones here?
So if it's not a Patreon movie night, because I do a movie night once a month for my patrons, if it's not that, I'm usually relaxing because I do most of my work throughout the week, so I try to take weekends off if I can. Mm-hmm. But Friday nights I'm usually like relaxing in my living room with my wife Erica, and like tonight, for example, I'd either be watching a movie, a horror film, or I'd be playing a game, Starfield most likely.
So before we get too far into this, tell me, how does it feel to have weekends off, to be able to relax? I mean, I'm not at work on the weekends, but I'm at work on the weekends. So like I go to work during the week to get a vacation from the weekend. So tell me, how does that feel?
Jay, we were talking before we went live about your job and everything. And, you know, how about, rather than I tell you about what it's like having weekends, what if I tell you what it's like not having a boss?
Even better, right?
Just to make you feel a little bit worse.
Yeah.
Jay,
or in my situation, several bosses that are never on the same page. So,
well,
oh, we just got a little personal. Okay. No one knows I do this show. So, okay.
Your management will pull you in on Monday. Oh, so we've seen this show called Paper Cuts, Jay. And,
I've got the comments open on the sidebar here. So, William, thank you for coming. Becky, yay. I hope you're feeling better. That's my agent.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I think that's Kevin, a cemetery dance. I could be wrong. But Kevin, if that's you, rock on, brother.
I think it's probably Kevin. So last time you were on the show, we did the re-release party for Devil's Creek.
Yeah.
And then subsequently throughout the summer, you went on a tour for that, the Summer of Dread tour. So how did your book tour go over the summer?
It went incredibly well. Especially the last leg, in Kentucky. It was exhausting. It was expensive as fuck. But you know what? It was great getting out and doing event, like actual like one-on-one events with, you know, the public as opposed to just cons and stuff. And I didn't get to do that for Devil's Creek when it originally released because of COVID. So it was great to get out and see the fans, see readers, and meet new ones who were just picking up my book on the off chance that they might like it. And I think a few of them did. One of them did not.
they let you know about it already?
Yeah, they hit Goodreads pretty quick.
Oh, wow.
So what did the tour consist of? Multiple cities, bookstores?
It was pretty much focused on the East Coast. I went as far north as Massachusetts and as far south as Kentucky. It started with a Barnes & Noble appearance for Devil's Creek. And Barnes & Noble, group events. We did a group event at Steel City Brewery in Phoenixville, PA. Me and other members of the PA chapter of the HWA. StokerCon, NeeCon, AuthorCon. Hey, Chad, thanks for showing up, dude. Appreciate it. You know, it's kind of a blur at this point. honestly, it's this summer went by so fast. Like, I can't believe it's, you know, we're almost into October now. And I feel like everything was over in a blink, just from so much travel, for me anyway. You know, we tend to drive everywhere within a reasonable distance. So yeah. Horror on Main, which was the first year for that con. Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on everything else.
Brad, you showed up to one of the...
Yeah, he came down to the tailless dog, yeah.
So how's it feel to have groupies?
I'll follow Todd anywhere.
I wouldn't call them groupies. I call them heathens.
Heathens, you have one. Heathens. I mean, Brad was the groupie. He had the...
I think he called... Yeah, you signed that right in here. Fellow heathens, I think, somewhere.
Yeah, get thee to church.
Yeah.
One of my canned sayings for books.
So I know you've done cons and stuff in the past, but this is your like actual first book tour that just wasn't strictly going to like a specific con?
Wasn't my first book tour ever. I did a small tour back in 2012 when my second novel was released.
Okay.
It's one of the Monochrome books, which nobody ever read. So yeah, it had been a while and I was long overdue.
Nice. I'm glad that we talked about it a little bit while, you know, I was down there in Berea, but you said it was pretty good turnout, most of those places and everything, which I think that's really cool. I feel like,
yeah,
for me, I'd be nervous if I was the author, like worried no one would show up. All
I mean, that's always a real concern. I mean, you're fighting against people's schedules, which you have no way of knowing. You're fighting against the elements. If it's raining, people are not going to go out. You know, if it's a weekend or a date that coincides with something else that's important socially, like I had a signing at the beginning of the summer that happened to fall on the day of prom.
Oh yeah.
So you know, there wasn't a lot of foot traffic, but you know, for the most part, it was surprising. I didn't expect the kind of turnout that I got. I'm also, you know, just a pessimist that way. I don't expect much. But, you know, I Butcher Cabin Books in Louisville was a good turnout for that. Tailless
Dog.
That's
a cool little store.
Yeah, it is. Had a great turnout at the Barnes & Noble in Lexington, which I didn't expect. It was just beyond my expectations. We'll put it that way.
Are these the stores you went to, do they have your books on the shelves, or did you rearrange that like ahead of time, maybe they'll so they could get some advertising and some promotion for you?
They had my books there. Like, I didn't take my books, they provided them. And I signed stock of what was left after each event.
Okay.
So Barnes & Noble in Lexington, Tailless Dog in Berea, Butcher Cabin in Louisville, Conquest Books and Coffee in Ashland, Kentucky. They, I believe, have signed copies still. At least I think Conquest did. They're running low, but I don't know. I mean, you're talking about something that was over a month ago.
Yeah.
So I hope that they've sold out and they've ordered more, yeah. but you never know.
I remember you telling me that you were surprised at the Barnes & Noble turnout. Like, I guess you weren't expecting as many.
Barnes & Nobles are always a crapshoot. You know, it's like either I've done Barnes & Nobles where they just kind of put you in a corner and give you a stack of your books. And what they have is what they have. They don't have any extras for you if you do sell out. Uh-huh. And, you know, they're just kind of like, they don't want to be bothered. And then you do Barnes & Nobles, like the one in Wilkes-Barre or Libby Place in Richmond, or the one in Lexington. They were gung-ho. They like were all about it. They checked on us. They put us right up front, you know, where people walked in. Mm-hmm. You know, I had nothing bad to say about it. It was great placement. They were enthusiastic about having me there. I was their first event since COVID, which was nuts. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So like they have a lot of competition with an indie bookseller there in Lexington, Joseph Beth. And
yeah,
Joseph Beth was my first choice. But for reasons beyond me, we couldn't get something arranged there in time. So maybe in the future. But you know, Barnes & Noble was eager to have me, and it went great.
So overall, you had a pretty good experience for the tour.
Yeah.
Get in the future to get spreading the word about your work and all.
Yeah. It's like I'll definitely do a tour again, but you know, I need to sleep a lot first.
I'm glad that Barnes.
Go ahead.
I'm glad that Barnes & Noble treated you well, especially the one in Lexington, because their horror section's not that big. So I'm glad that they treated a horror author.
But you know what? For what they have there, they have a decent selection. And they actually had Mallerman's new one, Spin a Black Yarn, on the shelf before it was released.
So there you go. Get your early copies.
Go to that Barnes & Noble because they don't care about street dates.
That's actually on your sign outside. We don't care about street dates. Yeah.
That's the Barnes & Noble I go to, is the one in Lexington. So,
I'll ask them about their secret stock. Is this something you would suggest to up-and-coming authors, writers, you know, trying to get the word out for their books, if they're able to do a little tour like this? You know, or is this something that you want somebody that's got a few years under their belt before they go out and do something like that?
I mean, I'll give my advice, but I'm not a guru on it. You know, a person better to talk about that, I think, would be Philip Fracassi, because he just wrapped up like a 20 or 30 date tour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he went to the UK too.
Yeah, he's over there right now, I think. You know, Brian Keene would be another one to ask about that. Just, you know, he's done multiple tours. But for me, if I were just starting out, I would, you know, keep it small.
Mm-hmm.
If you're driving and having to travel, like, and stay somewhere overnight, you know, try to be as frugal as you can, because it does add up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, plan ahead. Whenever you're thinking about doing the tour, start planning it like at least 6 months in advance, mm-hmm. if not longer. You know, I really only started firming things up with folks around March of this year. And in hindsight, I should have started last summer. just, it really depends on how much you want to do,
right?
You know, how far you want to go. You know, try to find bookstores that will stock your book, and also try to find bookstores that are receptive to horror, because some aren't,
right.
Some are not at all. And, you know, always start with the indies. I would focus on indies, honestly, and then, you know, sprinkle in the big box stores here and there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to, you know, spend a whole show on that, but I'm just curious about it. Like, when you were setting this up and you were contacting, or you had some people contact these certain stores, were there any that were like, Todd, who, we don't do this. We don't, you know, you have to give names, but like, you know, we don't have authors come in. Were there any kind of pushback, any trouble getting in a lot of these places?
I mean, usually in cases like that, you just don't get a response.
Okay.
But you want to go somewhere that at least like caters to the horror fans. You know, right. You're not going to see me selling Devil's Creek in a Christian bookstore, for example.
Well, that would be awesome.
It would be awesome. But you know, it's a religious book about redemption.
We could probably find a way to spin that. Just FYI. I mean, we could probably.
Todd walks in the doors and bursts into flames.
Give a look every time somebody, you know, pays to get one signed, give them a little bottle of holy water and just watch it, everything burn. Oh, I'm thinking of something now. Go ahead.
It evaporates.
To Jay, thanks for buying my book, Jesus Died for Nothing. Sincerely, Todd Keefe. Man. No, you want to make sure that they have, you know, they do have the foot traffic to support something like that. So you got to do a little bit of homework if it's a place you're not familiar with. Mm-hmm. But what was the other part of your question?
I don't remember, to be honest with you.
He was basically asking if the bookstores were receptive for the most part.
Oh, right. Yeah. When you reached out to them, I mean, did you get any kind of like,
stir up controversy is what he's trying to do.
I don't want to spend the whole show on this. I'm just curious on how one would set up a tour like this. Educational for people listening and watching, Brad.
Okay.
There are two published writers on this show right now. Just FYI.
you try to look up bookstores that are open to horror authors, right. And you know, there wasn't like pushback per se, but it was just like they were trying to set expectations. Like, we're a small store. Mm-hmm. We don't do a lot of events, but we're happy to have you.
Right, right.
And so in cases like that, I definitely tried to get the word out and promote it. And I sent them some promotional material for their shop and everything to help, you know, facilitate that foot traffic that they're worried isn't going to show up. Because, mm-hmm. you know, realistically, how one event goes may determine whether or not they do more. That's true. So you want to make, you know, you want to try to do your part to help them ensure that that foot traffic is there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Any other controversy you'd like to stir? Yeah.
I do want to ask about the Tailless Dog one, because they had a few, like local artists there that did like horror inspired stuff. Did you help set that up, or was that the store that brought
that? It was just luck. I think that I contacted them when I did. They had a number of horror artists that had approached them about doing an event. And when I got in touch, that was kind of what finally got them to move on it.
Okay.
So they could have a bunch of people at one time. And, you know, I asked Laurel to partner with me on that event. And when I do a tour again, I think I'll do more of that. You know, kind of, you see like Rob Atone doing it. You see Eric LaRocca doing it for Kazi, especially. I think it's all he did on every date. He had another author there with him to kind of have a discussion. Rather than it just be, you know, a reading and them sitting at a table the entire time.
Right.
I think that's a really good tactic honestly. Mm-hmm. And it also kind of takes some of the pressure off your shoulders.
Yeah, it sounds like it will. Like you have somebody to bounce things off of to just get things moving some and getting a discussion open.
That's yeah. Pretty
cool. Yeah.
And maybe you bring the other author's fans in too. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. You get this, fans in there. You get this cross pollination a little bit, mm-hmm. Which is always good.
Yeah.
Laurel agrees. Definitely nicer to have two.
Thanks again, Laurel.
It was a cool little event down there. I'd go back again if they did something.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a nice little shop. Mm-hmm.
So we'll move on from the Devil's Creek and the Summer of Dread tour, which, by the way, that's a cool title for your book tour.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've got this nice little sweet nugget coming out. Is it next Tuesday?
It's coming Tuesday. 4 days. Nice. Yeah.
So how long have you been working on this book, Cold, Black, and Infinite?
So let's see. Last year, I realized I had enough short fiction to put together a manuscript. Mm-hmm. So I guess last spring I was started curating it, putting it all together, figuring out the order of things, the structure I wanted it to follow, and which new pieces, you know, I wanted to put in there. And I think the last piece that I finished was We've All Gone to Crooked Town. Thanks for coming, Kat. Have a good night. So the last piece I did was We've All Gone to Crooked Town, which was originally titled Make a Wish, which was an experimental prose poem, you know, format that I'd always wanted to try. And so once that was done, you know, I put it all together. Cemetery Dance had just opened for, you know, manuscripts at the time. So my agent at the time, you know, shopped it to them. Kevin bought it, and, you know, the rest is history. So that's pretty much, I mean, there wasn't a lot of like brooding over, you know, over what to put in it, what to leave out. Like I did for a minute consider splitting it in half and having two mm-hmm. collections.
Oh,
you
have enough for another collection though?
Not enough for another collection yet. Okay. thanks, Kevin. you know, I'm working my way toward it already. You know, it's a nice thing about short stories is that, you know, it doesn't require a huge time commitment, and, you know, you send them out into the world. If they get published, great. If they don't, they just go in a folder and sit for a time when, you know, it's time to collect them into something. So yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of deliberation other than, you know, should I split this into two collections and just have like two releases instead of one? But I tried that with my first collection, mm-hmm. Ugly Little Things. Like that was originally going to be two volumes, and we decided to just do one book and focus all of our resources on one book. And ultimately that's what, you know, decided it for me was, you know, it makes sense to do that. And I'd rather get it all out there, and once it's done, you know, I don't have to worry about it. I can go work on the book I was working on at the time.
Yeah.
So
go ahead, Jay.
I was going to ask, what's the time frame for these? What's the oldest story in this? Oh, or God. Did you do everything together just last year?
Hey, Bo. Time frame. I mean, these stories go back. I wrote in the afterword for the book that this collection kind of comprises the last 5 years of my writing career.
Okay.
And I approached it as a greatest hits album of sorts. But the oldest story goes back to 2007, 2008.
Oh, wow.
And that's the story Black Friday. Didn't get published until 2014, I think it was, or 2015. I don't remember exactly when it was published, but that story I originally wrote in the early aughts, mid aughts, late aughts, whatever. I wrote it in the aughts, okay? In the aughts.
So how many stories do you have in there that are brand new, haven't been published before for this new one?
So We've All Gone to Crooked Town, The Happy Town, Yuletide Massacre, and Solve for X.
Nice. Those might be my three favorite. I like Solve for X a lot, and the Crooked Town one is really cool because that's what the cover is based on too.
Yeah, yeah. The cover is based on We've All Gone to Crooked Town, which kind of like a prequel story to my story that ends the collection. We've All Gone to the Magic Show.
Mm-hmm.
thanks, Laurel. Yeah. I didn't expect the cover to get as much reception as it did.
Go ahead. I don't want to cut you off.
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
I was going to say, did you write the story for the cover?
No.
Really?
No, the cover came from the story after the fact. Like, I originally wanted Francois Valancourt to do the cover. Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, Cindy. Thanks for coming. I wanted Francois to do the cover, but timing did not work out. So He had already lined up a bunch of other contracts, and I know he was having some health issues at the time. And, you know, I said to Kevin, like, you know, we need to get this book out there now, not, you know, 3 months from now and 2 months before release or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a stab at it in Photoshop because I already had the idea for the cover. I just wanted to see what Francois would do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I love his style and I love his approach to art. And so I took a stab at it, you know, and I'm not a painter. I'm not an illustrator per se. You know, I'm just a designer, but I know my way around Photoshop a fair bit. So I found some good stock photography that kind of matched what I had in my head. And I just played with it from there. Got really high one night and just focused on it. And that's how the cover came to be. And I love it. It's probably my favorite piece that I've done. I love
the way the cookie crumbles.
I love the how it looks like a painting.
It does, yeah.
Even though it is not, it's just a photo manipulation. And I don't know if Brad, I don't know if you noticed, but I attributed the cover art to Jack Tremley.
I did, yes.
From Devil's Creek.
That was cool.
Yeah. He'll be my alter ego when it comes to like visual stuff from time to time.
I really love how the cover fits that specific story so well too.
Thank you.
It's a really cool cover.
I had somebody commented on the cover. I had happened to see the alternate text that they had entered on social media for the image. And they described it as a shadowy figure holding an umbrella. That's not an umbrella. That's just part of the landscape that happens to be a
position. The little white kind of dot
yeah.
above it.
Yeah, that's not an umbrella. But hey, good
that's
try.
That's funny. It's too hot. There's no rain. Yeah, he's just hanging out. That's cool. I like the kid in the well and the giant hole. Yeah, that's cool. I like it a lot. I guess that's not the hole, though. Is that the forest, maybe?
My original idea was to have like this grotesque image of these figures kind of like all crawling over each other to get up the side of the cliff.
Oh yeah.
But that's beyond my ability.
So did you want the cover to be specifically drawn from one of the stories? Because sometimes short story collections covers will just be kind of random and not really have anything to do with the actual content. This one's pulled from the story.
I wanted it to be this one just because of what that story is about. And you know, it plays with the idea of creation and, you know, kind of becoming your own your own God, creating your own world. And that, in a sense, is exactly what writers are and artists in general. So I wanted something that kind of captured that, that desolation, that the end of something, the start of something else, and just the overall mood. I feel like the mood of that story kind of encompasses all the others. It kind of, I mean, obviously this is not a pun, but, you know, we were just talking about this. Everything kind of falls under that umbrella.
I think the cover fits for the title too, because it seems cold, like, and just infinite and dark, and
yeah,
it's what kind of this wasteland. It fits the title of the book too.
Thank you.
So sticking with that, when you were picking these stories for this,
hi, Holly,
was there a criteria you were looking for? Did you give yourself like a theme or a connection that when you're picking the stories you wanted in this, or was it just, hey, I have these done, let's go with these?
I have these done mostly, and it just so happened to work out that there was a thematic element to groups of them. Mm-hmm. Like the story's broken up into three sections: cold, black, mm-hmm. and infinite. So it, that was not by design, it just worked out that way, which usually is how
that made you realize it's all alright. Right?
Yeah, I mean, there's like there's some dark humor sprinkled throughout, but you know, there's also some pretty awful stuff in yeah. terms of what happens, not in terms of the quality. You know, there's some parts are more, you know, more extreme than others. Other parts will just leave you questioning existence. That's most likely falls into the infinite part, which is the most cosmic horror of the bunch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you were to sort of break down the sections, you know, cold, black, and infinite, can you say like the cold section is based on this kind of theme, maybe? Like, is there anything you can put in the words for?
You know, I don't know if you noticed, but the stories in cold, and let me open up the TOC just to remind myself of all the stories that are in there, because they all kind of blur together after a while. Yeah, Midnight in the Southland, 245 to New Zebico, Happy Town, Y2K, Black Friday. They all kind of involve the cold in some way. Like some of these take place in cold holiday months. You know, mm-hmm. Black Friday is it's America's favorite shopping holiday. It's a post-Thanksgiving yep. story. It's Happy Town is a Christmas story. Y2K takes place on, in the aftermath of Y2K in the year 2000. So January. Midnight in the Southland is cold for a different reason, and I don't want to give it away, but, you know, it fits. Same goes for 245 to New Zebico.
I just want to give a shout out to Red. We'll go.
Red.
I'm pretty sure she's on her anniversary date and she's in the chat.
Oh, so that's so nice of you to spend your anniversary with us, Red. Happy anniversary, my friend.
Yes, happy anniversary, Red.
Yeah, so like that kind of encompasses cold. Black is more like pitch black. It's getting dark. You know?
Yeah.
You know, these stories are, you know, black humor. Oh, thanks, man. You know, they get a little bit more bloody, a little bit more violent, and then we head into infinite, which is the way I described it. I think this was Satal at Conquest. I could be wrong. But again, good luck with the tropical storm. I can't recall exactly who I told this to, but basically I looked at it as the course of an evening. So like, you know, cold, it's sun's going down. It's getting mm-hmm. colder. Black is when we hit full dark, and infinite is when it's just the vastness of the universe overhead. You know, the Milky Way and everything. It's nothing but stars. to make you feel insignificant.
Yes. Small little speck. That's cool. I like that. I like the way you broke it up in here and that the sections are based off the title of the book. I think that was really cool.
Well, I would also be remiss if I did not mention the Cold Black and Infinite itself is a line of a Nine Inch Nails song.
Okay.
Yeah. Cold and Black and Infinite with Nothing Left to Lose from the song. Oh my God. I'm not a Nine Inch Nails fan if I can't think of this. Branches and Bones. That's it.
Also, I want to thank you for setting stuff in Kentucky. Because I love the first story might be my favorite, Midnight in the South, just because it's set in Kentucky.
You know, from based on reviewers' reactions, that seems to be the most popular one of the bunch. Yeah. And it's also where I got the name for the overall mythos that I'm building. That mm-hmm. started with didn't actually start with Devil's Creek. It goes back farther than that. There's a story in my first collection called The Harbinger, which is takes place in West Virginia, but it's the first appearance of the stone idols that mm-hmm. appear in Devil's Creek. But yeah, I mean Kentucky, Ohio, Tennessee, West Virginia, you know, they're basically it's not so much the Southland as it is Appalachia. Uh-huh. And the valley, you know, the Ohio Valley from the Appalachia. I mean, Appalachia runs all the way up through here. I mean, it's part of the Poconos, which is only like an hour and a half from me. So I'm not far from home in a sense.
Yeah.
And the overall picture, which I absolutely will not spoil for you tonight, does figure into the Appalachian Mountains in some form or fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So the Southland, is that's sort of your the Todd Kiesling verse then?
Kind of. I call it the Southland mythos because it all stems from me wanting to create something that's adjacent to the Lovecraftian mythos, but not on the coast of New England all the time.
Yeah, something a bit different.
Yeah. Yeah, something a little different, something, you know, a different pantheon of cosmic horrors.
What all stories have been set in the Southland so far? Obviously, the short story, Midnight in the Southland, Devil's Creek.
So there's The Harbinger from Ugly Little Things, Saving Granny from the Devil from Ugly Little Things, Devil's Creek exists in the Southland universe, Final Reconciliation, Scanlines. In terms of the stuff in Cold Black and Infinite, we've got Midnight in the Southland, The Gods of Our Fathers.
I can see that for sure.
Holes in the Fabric and the story of Gethsemane.
Okay.
I'm calling that one part of the Southland for reasons.
For reasons.
For reasons.
I think maybe one of the reasons I liked Midnight in the Southland so much, and maybe others are too, it was like the nostalgia factor, the very X-Files feel to it, which I was really digging.
Yeah, so it's that story came up in a weird way. Like I had, you know, I wasn't in a depressed state when I wrote it. I was just feeling very reflective, and I had been listening to a lot of Art Bell. Art Bell, you know, was a radio host of Coast to Coast AM all through the 90s into the 20-teens. Oh, thanks, Holly. I do too. So Art Bell passed away in like 2018, 2019. I don't remember exactly when, but and the Coast to Coast AM is still a show. But back in the 90s and the early aughts, it was basically the show where all the weirdos and nutcases would call in and talk about UFOs and weird shit that happened to them. And, you know, we've all gone to Crooked Town as a little bit of a nod to coast to coast as well, because there was this guy that called in. I think his name was Mel. Mel would call in to Art's show from time to time and talk about this massive hole in his backyard that he just kept throwing. he would throw stuff in. He was using it as a dump, but it never filled up. It was just bottomless. And
then one night swallowed his house and Mel was gone forever.
Well, it's just like they could never pinpoint exactly where he lived because it was all bullshit. But yeah, back to the Southland for a second. I mean, I had been listening to a lot of reruns of the show. Erica and I had just come back from Richmond, actually. We were staying with my friend Dave and his wife Sam, and he had taken us to the ferry. And yeah. I lived in Lexington for, 4 years, had no fucking idea there was a ferry between Lexington and Richmond. But it makes sense considering Clay's Ferry. Right. You drive over Clay's Ferry. Yeah. It never clicked because I wasn't a bright person. So he took us over this, and I'm like, this would make a really good setting for a story. Right. I just didn't know how. And it got me thinking about going on night drives when I was in college, before I met Erica. I had gone through a pretty bad breakup, and I was kind of having to find myself a little bit and felt a little bit lost at the time. Mm-hmm. So I would go on these drives late at night and just kind of explore the city and explore the surroundings. And I married that up with the ferry idea. Kevin, who was not the editor for Cemetery Dance at the time, he was editing an anthology for Cemetery Gates called Liminal Spaces. And he had invited me to submit to that. And so you get into the idea of the nighttime kind of being a liminal space. You get into the idea of the ferry crossing from one side to the other while you're in the middle. That's also a liminal space. And I've got a love for liminality in fiction. I took a class on liminality in college. And that's one of the things I retained from my college days. One of the few things. So I was able to kind of marry that all up. And, I don't name her, but there's a reference to a certain radio DJ from Devil's Creek.
Yeah.
In that, and it all just kind of came together in this weird confluence, and the story just came out of that. It wasn't like I didn't plan for it. It was just one of those things where I needed to write a story about liminality. Mm-hmm. And Southland is what I came up with, and framing it all with this fictional radio host that's based on Art Bell, Gus Guthrie, allowed me to kind of set the mood, and the rest was magic.
Now, this might be weird to categorize it like this, but for me, this one almost felt like cozy horror in a way, that specific story. I don't know. It was very like, it's weird to say it was a comforting story. I don't know what is about it, but maybe the nostalgia coming in with like the X-Files and I like the Lonely Traveler and all that stuff. Just, I don't know. There's something comforting about it in a way. I don't know. Maybe that's completely off base and weird to say, but.
Well, no, I can. It's absolutely there. I mean,
it made me a little reminiscent of when I was younger and I was first trying to break into radio. Cause I mean, that's why I probably like it the best of the whole collection because of the whole radio connection. Mm-hmm. But like, I remember when I was breaking into radio, like I would, some of these smaller towns that I had to go to, I'd spend hours at night in like AM and FM looking for a signal that I know is very weak. So it's coming from a long, far away, trying to catch somebody that's doing a weird show like that,
Yeah.
And because I didn't know what I was doing when I first broke into it. I was trying to find my voice and everything. But I was like, man, if I can get like one of these that's become syndicated, and I'd still probably be doing it. But it's always fun trying to find that show that was kind of allowed the listeners to be on the air with them and just talk about weird things like that. So when I was reading that, I was like, this is pretty cool. This kind of hits home. Because I remember coming across Art Bell a couple of times in some of the small places I used to live. It was always a weak signal. I don't know why, but it was just, you know, AM back then. So
like that, I'm definitely dating myself here, but so my first time I ever heard of Art Bell was at the end of Tool's album Lateralis. There is a track that is basically a heavily modified version of this guy who called in to Art's show in a panic, claiming he was from Area 51, and he was talking about all the, you know, the weird shit and everything, and like they're trying to trace him. And what's crazy is that the satellite that was, you know, broadcasting Art's radio feed actually went down during that conversation. So that made it, that gave it this bit of legitimacy. But it was later, you know, the guy who staged it all, he called in and, you know, confessed that it was all fake. But so I heard that, you know, and I'm like, what the fuck is this from? So I looked
up. Is that after the silence part or for the album?
It's the last track. Okay. Yeah, it like
There's like the last, there's like almost 2 minutes of silence after one track, and then another one picks up at the very end. So if I remember correctly, that particular album, but yeah. Okay. I'll go back and check it out again.
Yeah. It's the last track. So I looked up Art Bell, and this is still in the days of Napster. So you could, you know, so I downloaded a bunch of his episodes and listened to him, and that was my introduction. So we're talking like back 2001, like before I started college.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was my introduction to Art Bell.
Are those shows still available somewhere? Just, I guess, on YouTube or something?
I follow, it's on Spotify as a playlist, and it's like Art Bell Archives or something like that. Just do a search on Spotify.
I'm betting there's probably a station or two somewhere that's still, like, still overnight syndication stuff. Yeah.
Well, from what I understand, Coast to Coast AM still exists. It's hosted by George Norrie now, and it's not as good. Mm-hmm. But they, like, you can subscribe to them and get access to Art Bell's archives. So yeah, if you like all that weird shit, you got to look up Art Bell.
There's really no shows, at least not that I'm aware of, that are like that anymore.
It's changed so much.
There might be, but it's not the same, because it's all, yeah, it would probably be like a podcast or something. It's just not the same as way it was back, like in early 2000s and late 90s and stuff.
It's TikTok streamers and creepypasta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I got into it way too late. Like, that's like, if I would have got into radio 10 or 15 years earlier than what I did, I may still be in it. I may have been grandfathered into one of those, you know, old veterans that, I'll tell you how radio was when I was a kid. We had to splice together tape, and I'd be one of those people. But no, I got into it too late. And it was by the time I got into it, it was being taken over by big companies.
Clear Channel
was buying up everybody. CBS was selling off other places. So I lost, I don't know how many jobs I lost. I got tired of moving around. So, and then you would get go to one of these small places. Like I worked in one in Parkersburg, West Virginia. Like here I am in Ohio. I stayed on the Ohio side, side of the river, because I didn't want to live in West Virginia. Parkersburg, West Virginia. It is like a little independent company making no money because they couldn't compete with Clear Channel. So yeah, it was so bad at one point. But go ahead.
Did y'all have any weird shows like that on yours, or is it just music?
Well, we had an AM station, and that's actually, okay. I want to say, I don't think we carried Art Bell, but we had a couple of, you know, eyebrow raising kind of shows that were on that AM station that, you know, because nobody was live on it. It was all syndicated shows from around the country for that. So,
yeah.
But that, you know, that's down in, you know, Southern Ohio, where I was living at the time. So there were some weird conspiracy theorist people around. And so, of course, the AM station was perfect for them. So, yeah.
That's stuff. I don't believe in really any of those conspiracy theories, but they're so fun to listen to.
Exactly. Like they're a guilty pleasure. Like they're all bullshit and some of them are super far fetched, but I think what I enjoy the possibility.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoy kind of thinking, well, what if for a second and, you know, but that's me. And I do that for a living now. So, you know, what if
it's fun to fall down that rabbit hole. Every
yeah. Just yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, it's a guilty pleasure for me right up there with ghost hunting shows, which are so
same
stupid.
For me, man. I love ghost adventures. I don't believe a word they say, but that's such a fucking cool show.
I wouldn't say it's cool. Zach's it's kind just, of a douchebag, but
he is. You know, I like Aaron a lot. Aaron is cool.
I love the guy that they always make him go off on his own, sit in a room.
Aaron's a tall, bald guy.
And that's who I'm talking about then. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, all right, Aaron, we're going to send you off on your own and let you scare the shit out of yourself.
Like I haven't watched it for a while, but it was always funny when they would like explain the equipment they were using and it made it sound like it was, they made it like it was so high tech and like, you know, this would do this. It was like two walkie talkies with duct tape around it and all kinds.
Like it's an Xbox Kinect that you like, yeah. You know, homebrewed yeah. into this, something
this would
else.
This would pick up the temperature and the voice that we can't hear. Only dogs can hear. And you're like, it's a Radio Shack walkie talkie held together. You're holding in the 9-volt battery with duct tape. What?
That's funny you say the Kinect because they really do use the Kinect.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Because they do it night vision, so you can see all the infrared dots all over the place. They're like, oh, watch something will walk in front of it. That's funny.
And then they did that in one of the Paranormal Activity films, and after that, it wasn't cool.
Oh yeah, I did get to meet the Ghost Adventures dudes at Scarefest one year, and Aaron, he was really cool. Zach wasn't bad in person. Aaron was really cool in person, though. That was back when the other guy was still on there, though. I think his name was Nick when it was the original.
Yeah, players. Before they had a falling out.
Yeah.
Were those the plumbers?
No, that's no. Thinking of.
That's Taps. I think.
Yeah. Taps. Okay, yeah. It was the same thing. You know what we do? We come in and we do this, and it was like they were using the same like editing program to listen for voices that I used to put together. Our audio stuff that I stole from a radio station. So it wasn't like anything special high tech. I always got a kick out of it.
Like I totally don't believe any of that, but I don't know. It's fun to watch. I don't know why. Yeah. My wife and I used to, every Saturday night, we'd watch Ghost Adventures and whatever the new episodes would come out back in the day, back before we had kids.
We did too. And one more thing about Ghost Adventures before we, you know, move on. It's probably one of my favorite things. This actually was one of those shows talking about Ghost Adventures. It was like Talk Soup or something that was on back in the day. I don't remember. Uh-huh. But basically, they focused on this one episode of Ghost Adventures where they went to Romania to investigate
like Dracula's castle or something. I think.
And they came across this pond. And there was a dead pig in the pond floating, and there was a frog sitting on top of it. And this talk show guy, this host, referred to it as a Muppet murder suicide. And that's always stayed with me.
So it really has nothing to do with Ghost Adventures.
Ghost Adventures was the catalyst. Sorry.
It had to be Talk Soup then, right? It had to be.
I'm pretty sure it was Talk Soup or it was like Daniel Tosh or somebody. I don't know.
That's funny. So do you believe in ghosts at all? Even though you.
Do I?
The show, yeah, even though you think the shows are crap, do you believe in ghosts at all?
I haven't made up my mind. I think it's more likely that what we experience as ghosts is actually more along the lines of, you know, quantum theory and one reality bleeding into the another.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I'm not even going to pretend to know what happens when we die, but I would like to think that we basically step out of this universe into another one.
Okay.
You know, I know that sounds kind of hokey, but it's no more hokey than we go to heaven or hell.
Yeah. Reincarnation or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah. It's kind of like a, we move laterally into the next, you know, basically like moving laterally into a different reality where we're still ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I find that plausible, but I'm also a weirdo, so who knows? But yeah, that's the only thing to me scientifically that would make sense to explain ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually err on the side of science.
I think reincarnation would suck. If you came back as another person and just had to start all over, just like thinking of going through school again and everything like that.
Yeah, it's like horrible. It's like starting New Game Plus in a game and not having any of your, you know, you don't even get to remember.
Yeah.
What happened.
Your prior experiences with you, you just got to start blank slate. That would be horrible.
Yeah, it's like you might for a while as you're a child, but by the time you grow up and be able to act on that experience, you've forgotten it all.
Yeah, it's just like you're like just a couple days old, you're an infant, and you still remember everything from your past life, but you can't vocalize it, and then it all fades away. It'd be terrible.
Yeah. You just kind of, you basically just are this adult brain trapped in the body of a infant mm-hmm. that can't speak or, you know, have any authority to say anything that, you know, to do anything that matters.
And I'll segue that into one of your stories.
Since we got so deep.
Which one is it? Let me think of the name. It's the one you read down in Berea with Karen.
Oh, yeah. Afterbirth.
Afterbirth, yes.
I think that was
probably your funniest one. And I think it made it as even funnier because you named the woman Karen. I don't know why.
Necromancy isn't for everyone, Karen.
That's right.
Yeah, that story was a fun one to write. I forget what the Republicans had done to piss me off that day. but I remember I was having coffee with Summer Cannon. And I was telling her like this idea that I had. And she's like, you have to write that. So I went home and I wrote most of it in a day. And because I was angry, I usually write pretty fast and sharp when I'm angry. So
that's
yeah,
a dark
that
story
one,
too. That's dark.
Thank you. I wrote that for the first and only issue of Weird Whispers that was put out by Nightscape Press back in 2020, 2019. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly when. It was originally published under the title Pro Life. So I changed that, obviously, to something a little bit less politically charged.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's one of my favorites too, and it's always like for the folks who weren't there at my signing in Berea, Laurel read a short story from her new collection, Every Woman Knows This, which if you don't have it, you need to buy that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the story Afterbirth, but before I did, I gave the audience a choice. I said, do you guys want something funny? Or do you want something gross? And everybody wanted gross, except for this one lady who wanted funny. So I apologized to her before we started. And then I read the story Afterbirth. The owner of the store got up and walked out of the room. It was pretty awesome.
The best part was your mom's reaction.
My mom was so
disappointed.
My mom was sitting there. In front of me, my mom came to the show and she's sitting there and every, from time to time, I would just look down from the book and just look right at her. Almost like I was reading the story to her because she'd never read that one before. And so that was a lot of fun for me. I don't know if other people enjoyed it. But I had a blast.
I thought that was great. And your mom's reaction was just killing me. She was just shaking her head and she was trying so hard not to just laugh.
So for a preview for the folks who, you know, haven't read the story before or heard me read it publicly. the story is about a disturbed woman who wants a child so badly that she turns to necromancy to grow her own child from the amniotic waste she's stealing from an abortion clinic.
Mm-hmm. Jade, you're shaking your head. That's just exactly what Todd's mom was doing.
But the story is told from the perspective of the entity in the bucket that she summoned.
Yeah.
Is this the one you're reading for us tonight?
No, I'm not reading that one tonight.
Well, I'll plug, if you go watch my vlog, the Summer of Dread vlog, I have a snippet of the beginning of that story in there and read it from the book event.
Yeah. So
speaking, do you want to go ahead and do your reading?
We can do that. So, there was some deliberation tonight as to what I was going to read. Didn't want to read Afterbirth because I've already read it publicly. I would love to read Midnight in the Southland, but I'm not going to because that episode of Pseudopod is coming soon. And yeah, you can listen to the full audio on Pseudopod, and I can't wait to hear what they've come up with. So tonight I'm going to read a few scenes from the beginning of my story, Annie's Heart is a Haunted House, which first appeared in The Hideous Book of Hidden Horrors, published by Bad Hand Books and edited by Doug Morano. So this one's for Doug, who may or may not be watching. Thanks for buying my story and taking a chance on it, man. Annie's Heart is a Haunted House. Sheila was the next to go. Before her, Tobias and Jenny. Now there was only Rich and me, standing in the foyer and staring at the shredded remains of our fellow inmate, half a torso and one leg. Some of her insides were scattered across the floor, and the whole foyer was a skating rink coated in her blood. There was no mistaking it. The housemaster had been here, and it had treated Sheila like a grisly pinata. "We were only gone for a couple of minutes." Rich turned to me, his cheeks slick with tears, and held out his hands in defeat. I stood at his side and looked at the dead girl. She'd survived longer than I expected. How many days had it been now? Sheila was the one who kept count, scratching a thin line in the upstairs hallway for every sleep cycle. With the windows bricked up, we had no idea if time even existed here. But it kept Sheila busy, gave her a purpose. She was going to be my girlfriend, Rich said, and dropped the fire iron at his side. Last night, he turned to the stairs in the direction of our sleeping host. You crazy bitch! His knees buckled, and I watched him sink to the floor in despair. I reached out to comfort him, but thought better of it. There's no point now. We made a rule in the beginning. Never go anywhere alone. It was a rule we learned the hard way. Rich had wandered away from us in search of a bathroom while we bickered amongst ourselves, confused, disoriented, scared. This doesn't make sense, man. Tobias tugged on the chains barring the entry doors. Four chains, the heavy-duty kind with thick links and bound by multiple locks. Defeated, he paced the foyer and mumbled to himself, I went to bed. In my bed. How the fuck did I end up here? How did any of us? Sheila was a crying mess. Jenny held her, tried comforting her friend, but it was no use. She was equally frightened, and for good reason. We'd each gone to sleep in our own beds and homes scattered across town, and had woken up together in this massive house. A mansion, by the look of it. Everything was ornate and immaculate. Not a speck of dust or sign of clutter, with dual chandeliers above and a large fountain at the far end. Mounted animal heads above the doorway, one moose and a boar on either side. Red walls, white crown molding, polished hardwood floors. It was something right out of a magazine, picture perfect and untouched. Someone's idea of bourgeois living. and then we heard Rich screaming for help. We found him at the end of a long hallway. He clung to the edge of a hole in the floor, dangling above a hazy red void. Tobias took hold of Rich's hand and pulled him to safety. "How'd you miss a giant hole in the floor, dumbass?" "No," Rich whimpered. "It wasn't like that. I was walking and the floor just gave out beneath me." A square flap of flooring unfolded it by itself and sealed the hole. The trapdoor's outline was barely visible in the glow of gas lights adorning the hallway walls. No wonder Rich hadn't seen it. Sheila found her voice between sobs and asked, "What is this place?" "Shh, it's okay." Jenny looked to me and then to Rich. Her face slowly drained of color as realization took hold. "Could have been any one of us. Are we going to die here, Jen?" She put her arm around Sheila, gave her a squeeze. "Shh, no, Sheila, no. Right, guys?" Silence slipped between us. We were all thinking the same thing and were too afraid to say it. 3 days passed before we saw the house master for the first time. We were tired, strung out, panicking because we hadn't felt hunger or the need to relieve ourselves. Everything had stopped. We were trapped in a prison of better homes and gardens, and at first it seemed like everything was over, that the world had come to an end. God, we were so wrong. And I only wish we had remained ignorant. But then, that's the nature of our punishment, isn't it? "I don't have time for this reality TV bullshit!" Tobias raged to no one, screaming until his voice fried and he exhausted himself. He looked to me and Rich, and then to the girls. I can't be here. I've got a game tomorrow. Or was that yesterday? He collapsed on the floor, chest heaving, chin quivering. I saw a tear slip from his eye. Tobias's forlorn proclamation echoed our quiet sentiment. We were 17 in our last year of high school. We had final exams and games and parties. Well, most of us. The others were so popular. At the top of our social pyramid, Tobias was a linebacker for the football team and had a full university scholarship waiting for him in the fall. Jenny ran track and was the president of both the National Honor Society and the drama club. Sheila was the homecoming queen and captain of the dance team. Rich was the class president and an active member of the Future Business Leaders of America. And then, at the very bottom, there was me. I was the odd man out of our imprisoned group, an art nerd, president of the National Art Honor Society. I was, too. Spent most of my spare time in the art room. No scholarship, no real friends, and no place among my peers. Even I didn't understand my presence in this place. "Please stop yelling," Sheila said. It was the first thing she'd spoken in more than a day. "It isn't getting us anywhere." She paused, shook her head in disappointment. "We all had things going on this weekend." Tobias snorted. "Whatever, Sheila. Nothing important, I'm sure." "Fuck you, Tobias." "Guys, please don't fight." Rich shot a look to me for support, but I shrugged in reply. What could I say that would make them calm down or even listen? He scoffed, annoyed by my silence, and raised his voice. "Seriously, stop the arguing. It isn't getting us anywhere. You want to come over here and make me tough guy?" Tobias shot to his feet, popped his neck, and glared. Rich shrank back, played off his panic with a shrug like the 220-pound brick of muscle wasn't worth his time. "Yeah," Tobias said, grinning. "That's what I thought." And then to the girls, "I don't see you two doing anything about getting us out of here. All I see is you whining about your fucking football game." Jenny had finally had enough. "Who gives a shit, Tobias? You whine about homework. You whine about Sheila not giving you the time of day. All you do is whine. Why don't you actually do something about it instead of crying like a little bitch?" I really thought he would hit her. He opened his mouth, closed it, shook his head. "Nah," he said. "Fuck this, and fuck all y'all too." He left us and took the stairs two at a time, his heavy footfalls rattling the whole house. Rich implored him to wait, but Tobias had said his piece, and there was no stopping that freight train. We looked at one another, listening to the guy's footsteps upstairs, and held our breath when the pounding started. Tobias kicked in every door he found in the upstairs hallway. He'd already worked his way to the far end by the time we reached the second floor. Tobias stared at us, trunk of his torso heaving with deep breaths and his face bright red. He had a runner's stance, was about to charge straight for us. Rich gasped. Jenny and Sheila held hands, shaking. Me, I readied myself for the impact. The jagged end of a broken wooden beam exploded from the ceiling and pierced Tobias' stomach. He gasped in shock, tried to scream, but all he managed was a slow, mewling groan. Another piece of wood, this one finally sharpened into a stake, shot from above and impaled him through his chest, pinning him in place. The others cried out in terror, but I was too shocked to make a sound. Instead, I could only stare and try to make sense of what I was seeing. The two wooden pieces were still attached to the ceiling, protruding from a cracked hole directly above Tobias, and I thought he'd fallen into another one of the traps. Pieces of plaster and crown molding broke away from the walls and merged together. Wires snaked through the cracks and wound their way around the two jutting timbers. Tobias was long dead at this point, a merciful end in retrospect. He never had to experience the truth of what killed him. We forgot our places in the social scheme and huddled together in fear. We whimpered as the housemaster assembled itself. We watched. Bits of drywall coated the floor and filled the air with dust. The gas lamps along the hallway formed eerie halos in the cloud, silhouetting a thing composed from pieces of the house. The creature's body was the size of a refrigerator, and its multiple arms of wood and rebar scraped the walls and creaked as they bent at the joints. It descended, examined its prey, and lifted Tobias's limp corpse. A makeshift door swung open from its chest, and in went the remains of our school's star linebacker. Satisfied with the kill, the housemaster walked to the nearby wall and merged with the structure. The whole upper level trembled with the creature's force, and within seconds, it was gone. A beat later, Rich said, "What the fuck was that?" And if you want to find out what the fuck that was, you got to buy Cold Black and Infinite.
Such language. Tuesday
from Cemetery Dance.
Nice. That's a good spot to leave off.
Yeah. Such language, Todd. Come on.
I know, right?
Jay was just cringing the whole time.
Oh, I wasn't cringe. I was just laughing every time. It was my favorite part. Fuck you, Tobias. I'm just going to go around saying that to people.
Fuck you, Tobias.
Becky said that's one of her faves.
Thank you, Becky. Thanks, author fan.
So, do you have a favorite story in here, or is that too hard to pick, like picking your favorite kids or something?
That's a Sophie's choice. You know,
Bo, you're one to talk about language.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, really.
Favorites. I mean, they're all favorites for different reasons. Like Midnight in the Southland is a favorite just because I feel like that's the one story everyone seems to agree on. Mm-hmm. So like I had a perfect balance there of everything. We've All Gone to the Magic Show is one of my favorites because that was my first sale at professional rates. Thank you, John Padgett, and the newly canceled Vastarian magazine, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. You know, like they're all my children.
That's so all my a weird question.
Sure.
Do you have one that pisses you off the most? For me, it was Tommy and Tommy the Destructobot versus the bullies from Future Street. With the scene in the bathroom, I was like, if that was my kid, I would be in jail. I would have murdered that bully. It would have been over.
Yeah. What pisses me off?
You said the one you wrote, Afterbirth, you said you wrote that one because
I was pissed off when I wrote it, but the story doesn't piss me off. It makes me laugh now. Black Friday was hard.
Black Friday, okay. Did you work retail?
What's that?
Did you ever work retail?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I wrote Black Friday about a year after I quit. Correction, 2 years after I quit working my last retail job. That was Staples. Mm-hmm. At Staples. I was the copy center guy who made all your copies. And they needed me there on Christmas Eve for some ungodly fucking reason.
So you're what? I think his name was Thomas. You're the guy that knows to shoot him in the head, the zombie.
Actually, no. That was based on a friend of mine at the time, Thomas.
Okay.
It was kind of like a nod to several friends, like my old manager, Matt. I sent the story to him. I sent the story to a few of my coworkers after I wrote it, because it was kind of like I wrote it before Christmas, so I wanted it to like send them to them as a gift because I was poor and couldn't afford to buy any real gifts. And there was a draft of it, and the thing is, it was too long. It's a novelette, so it was too long to get it to send it anywhere. And I tried shortening it at one point in time for a George Romero themed anthology, because it's my only zombie story. Uh-huh. And I hit my head against the wall with it because I couldn't find a good way to shrink the story down and still have it be as impactful. And so I bet I've revised that story 7 or 8 times.
Really?
And when I finally fixed it, completely changed it. Like the structure would bounce around, like it would bounce around in time frame. And that was part of the issue. I decided to just, you know, get over myself and just put it in a chronological order. Mm-hmm. And that fixed it.
Nice.
And it was one of those examples of me needing to get out of my own way. Mm-hmm. It pissed me off a lot just in trying to make it work. And, it got published. It was in one of the Deathlehem books for charity. And they ended up that particular edition. They started the book with Black Friday.
Oh, cool.
It's like, Oh, Unholy Night in Deathlehem, I think. I forget what charity that benefits, but they do one every year. And it was so long that I knew the odds of me actually getting paid for that one were pretty slim. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it appeared there first, and I did it as a standalone chapbook a couple of years ago through Godless.
Okay.
And yeah, that one pissed me off. You think? I mean, they've all pissed me off in some way or another. I'm hitting my head against the wall. Tommy actually was one that I struggled with. It took me like 6 or 7 years to write that story.
Really?
I wrote it. So Mercedes Yardley and I basically promised to each other that we were going to write the other into a story. And in her story, she wrote in like 2 days and got it published and everything, because that's what she does. My character is dead at the beginning of the story. And his name is Todd. So I wanted to write something that kind of captured her dark, whimsical persona. And that took form in the shape of Mercedes Future, the mad scientist at the end of the block. But, you know, I struggled with the beginning of that story for years. I would go back to it every so often, and it just didn't feel right. Didn't, you know, something about it would piss me off, and I'd put it away and work on something else, which is usually how a lot of my short fiction happens. If it's not written for someone. Like, I've got five stories in various states of progress right now from going back several years because I couldn't find the right thread, or I haven't found the right thread yet, or, you know, I just got sidetracked, or I wrote part of it and then felt lukewarm about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always have a handful of those in my back pocket. I'll probably try to dust one of them off and revise for another open call before the end of this year. But yeah,
I'm curious.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Finish your thought. I'm sorry.
I'm like, but yeah, I mean, they've all, I hit my head against the wall at some point with everything I write, and what gets published is, you know, usually the result of hitting my head very many times.
I want to ask, with those ones that you said that one took you forever to write a couple of years. As authors, you know, your voice changes, or mm-hmm. you know, you grow as an author. So when you go back and work on something like, say, now that you started 5 years ago, do you feel a difference in, you know, what you're adding to the story now as opposed to what you wrote back then? Then you have to change the whole thing to sort of fit your voice now.
That
makes sense, what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, it does. And then, you know, it absolutely, your voice changes, you know, your word usage changes, you know, you start something. I mean, let's use Devil's Creek as an example. You know, I started mm-hmm. writing and taking notes about Devil's Creek in 2007. And I tried to write it then, and it was just a jumble of different scenes. I didn't know where they all fit in the scheme of things. So I put it away for about 7 years.
Really?
Yeah. And I picked it up in 2014 and played around with it some more. And, you know, I had lost a couple of the scenes. Like, I still had the notes, but I lost in a hard drive crash some of the working document that I had, which was fine. But then, you know, I wrote like the opening scene with all the grandparents driving into the woods. You know, that's mm-hmm. from 2014. The scene with Riley and his youth group in the woods camping, that's from 2014. And again, I ran into the same problem. I couldn't figure out where I wanted everything, how to tell the story, and what order to tell the story. So I set it aside again until 2016, 2017. I forget exactly when I picked it up. 2017, mm-hmm. I think. And, you know, everything that I had written, you know, I went back and revised.
Okay.
Because, you know, you grow. It's only natural. Your voice is going to change. Your word usage is going to change because you're always growing. You have more experience to draw from. And I feel like that one's experience is really, or at least in my, you know, speaking personally, my experience in life and talking to people and reading and just being part of the world around me informs the way I talk, informs the, you know, what words I use on the page. So it's absolutely something old absolutely is going to get revised when it comes to my process, because who I was when I started it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And all that's really good for going back to old stuff is having, you know, the bones of a story to kind of flesh out. Yeah. And, you know, and then
you got that, it's almost like the idea too.
Yeah. It's the kernel of the idea, but it's also the concept of the story is there. The general direction I want the story to go in, but maybe I wasn't, you know, in the right frame of mind to write that story yet. So it had to percolate a little bit. Hey, Chad. Oh, Brad is typing.
Sorry.
Hey, Christina, I didn't see you slip in there.
So I also want to mention the, so you did the, I'm assuming you did all the interior design and everything for,
yeah,
for this one, the new one.
Yeah. Yeah. After Devil's Creek, I was asked to keep things minimal.
Also, that's putting it lightly, right? I love this page.
Oh, thank you.
That's such a cool page.
That was that's from We've All Gone to Crooked Town. That's my,
I'll show Devil's Creek. I don't know if it'll come through, but like the corruption gets more and more as
it gets dark, it gets darker and darker and darker. So for the black section of this, you should have had all black pages with white lettering.
So here's the thing. I would love to do that, but the main printers, the commercial printers that everyone uses, Ingram and Amazon doesn't give a fuck. They'll print whatever you give them. Ingram, however, is very particular, and if your pages are too dark, they upcharge you on the paper stock. And I found that out with Hideous Book of Hidden Horrors, because we really experimented with the, you know, white text on a black background.
Yeah.
The problem is that they're not using black paper. They're printing on white paper, so they're using like all this toner to print.
Yeah.
So that's where
that's
the problem
a lot of ink they're using. Yeah.
So
yeah,
the pages would stick together, and it was their process.
Right, right.
There was a book I read recently, and every now and then it'd have solid black pages. You could tell it was ink because they were kind of curled over a little bit.
Yeah. So you need like a specialty press that's going to print it on black stock.
Right.
And who knows how much that would fucking cost.
Ridiculous.
That would be, yeah, ridiculous. I would totally, if I could go back and do it and I wasn't restricted to the kind of design I could do, I would totally just have it fade and get darker and darker where it's like white text on, you know, black background.
That'd be sweet.
You still here, Kevin?
The deluxe special edition, you know,
yeah. Maybe one day.
Only 10 copies, $500 each.
Seriously, they'd have to be, probably.
Yeah. Do that with like Thunderstorm Books or something. They'd probably do something like that.
Be like a $2 profit. Yeah.
So do you enjoy doing the design aspect of a book, not just writing a book, but designing what it
looks
like?
Yeah, it allows me to stretch a, you know, different part of my brain, put it to work. I tend to dive into visual stuff when the well is dry for writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's also, you know, how I pay the bills these days. I do design work for other authors and publishers, and you know, it's nice to be able to have something else to pivot to that's still creative. And I think Becky Spratford, she reviewed Cold Black and Infinite for Booklist, and she mentioned about how my experience as a designer shows in my language choices. And thank you, Holly. Thank you. How that having a visual background informs that and makes a bit more of a visual experience when you're reading my work. And that's, she really hit the nail on the head there, because that's always been one of my goals as a writer, because I was destined for a career in graphic design and or possibly film before I ever thought about being a novelist. And that all changed when my senior year of high school, I turned a screenplay that I'd written with like no budget, I turned that into a novel.
Okay.
And that kind of changed my trajectory, because I took that novel with me to college. It guidance counselor said I should submit it to this award that they have. It took second place. I got paid for the first time ever for any of my writing. And that I declared an English major, and everything else is history. But, you know, my interest in art and film never went away. And, you know, I tried to think about I try to think about how I'm going to portray something on the page so that I can give you the same image in your head that I see in mine. Mm-hmm. If I can manage to do that and it's vivid, then I've done my job. Doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes it's, you know, I fall short, but that's part of growth. That's part of, you know, you keep going and keep trying.
To go along with that, I also think you do a good job though of not over detailing things where, you know, you are just driving home that one picture. You do a great job of allowing the reader to also make up the image too, without, you're not just, you know, every single thing about something, you're not saying it's this, this, and this. And
yeah,
this,
there's this big, definitely,
there's like a fine line there.
There's definitely descriptive, or yeah, it's a tightrope walk. You know, you have mm-hmm. to balance it. And, you know, so if you see me describing something in detail, it's for a reason. You know, mm-hmm. otherwise, you know, I'm a pretty lazy person. And if I can give the reader just enough so that they can formulate in their mind what the character actually looks like, then that's yeah. stuff, that's words I can use for something else. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to be economical in that regard. It doesn't always work out that way. I know some people criticize Devil's Creek because it said it was overwritten for that reason. But I don't give a fuck. I wrote the book I wanted to write. But, you know, I try to present enough to give the reader a suggestion of what they should be seeing.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes I want them to really focus in on it. Other times I just need it to be, you know, set dressing. It's there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there. So, you know, it's night, it's day, it's hot, it's cold. And over time, like starting out, I had to be conscious of, you know, doing that. And now it's kind of become just instinctual. You mm-hmm. do it enough. So, yeah.
Cold, black, and infinite.
It's, yes, sir.
What, Tuesday, right? Tuesday. That's what we're saying. Tuesday. From Cemetery Dance.
So it's available in paperback. It's available in this beautiful case-wrapped hardcover.
Are you doing some signed ones through your website, or?
So I took a pre-order for 1 week for signed copies. So that pre-order window has closed.
Okay.
I may, in the future, probably this holiday season. I've got
okay, cool.
I've got two more events lined up after this for, well, end of October and early November, and then I'm done traveling for the year. I'll be home. So I'll probably put whatever, you know, I'll probably order a small stock of books. So best advice I have there is just to keep subscribe to my newsletter if you haven't already. Keep an eye on my socials.
Yeah, and keep stalking, looking in your window.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's yeah. fine.
Todd's been great. Thanks so much for agreeing to hang out with us and talk about your stuff, talk about your book. Should be on everyone's list. If they haven't pre-ordered it yet, I mean, they could pick it up.
It's a great Christmas gift, guys. 16 Todd Kiesling stories. You can't go wrong with that.
Yeah. And it's got a couple of holiday themed stories in it. So it's perfect for the season. Yeah. So you might even say it's the reason for the season.
For the season.
Oh
yeah, it does. Oh. It's got Thanksgiving-ish story.
Black yeah, Friday it's story, got a
Christmas story.
It's got a it's a word I'm looking for. It's got a. It's gone. Easter. It's got an Easter story in it. We'll put it that way.
There you go.
See, it runs the gamut. It's got all the. It's all. Yeah. Got all the holidays in there.
So if you have a. 10-year-old niece that is the daughter of that relative you don't want to, you know, talk to anymore, this is definitely the book.
Get her this.
Yeah, that yeah. seems it won't scar anybody. It won't scar her at all, but it will probably make her parents not talk to you anymore. So if that's your goal,
go Jay, for it. I feel like this is coming from a personal place. Would you like to talk about it?
Oh, that's a whole other show.
Okay,
all right, Todd. Thanks. We appreciate you stopping by. Really.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks for chatting about it. And everyone in the chat, thanks so much for hanging out with us this evening. Cold, Black, and Infinite. the latest from Todd Kiesling. Written by Todd Kiesling,
designed by Todd Kiesling.
Yes.
Produced by Todd Kiesling. It's all Todd Kiesling, guys.
Story of my life.
Yeah. And Cemetery Gates. That's it. Check it out.
All right, guys. Thanks again. Thanks, everybody.
Sorry, yeah. Thanks for hanging out. Jay. I love you, Jay.
I know you do. Fuck you, Tobias.
Fuck you, Tobias.